Would you believe this is the third time I'm starting this podcast? And when we do live radio, I don't care if I flub, but I want this to go right. So a third time we're starting this podcast here. It's Friday, November 9th, about 3:30 or so. I wanted to get to this, by the way. It's Eric Chase. Welcome to the podcast. And I'm not going to ask you for a vote. If you haven't heard me mention this on the air, on the show each weeknight on Q105, I'm not going to ask you to vote for me for best radio DJ or best podcast in the city papers, best of Toledo, because I should have already done things to get that vote from you in August and in July. And so I'll just, instead of ask you, just tell you that voting is now open for all the categories for the city papers, best of Toledo. And, you know, I'll just say this. I don't like DJ. Like, that's a very antiquated, obsolete word. We're excuse me. We're radio hosts, personalities. It's a better way to go about it, but whatever. I can't fight that battle. So podcast and radio DJ are some of the categories that I'm included in with some familiar names. If you want to throw a vote there, I appreciate it. If I have impacted your life, if we have impacted your life in some way, a positive way, like we brought the old show into podcast form, we appreciate the vote. Today's podcast episode is just me. Yesterday, I was fortunate enough to be a part of the Epic Toledo Leadership Summit and Conference. A friend of mine, I totally forgot who sent me the submission form to nominate myself, and it was Heidi, who was there yesterday. Heidi from RFS Tackle, one of our great mental health resources in the area. Heidi, thank you. She's like, I'm the reason you're here. I was like, wait, oh, it was you who said submit myself. Sarah, Michael, and Emily from Epic Toledo. We got together in the summertime around August. I pitched them my idea, and they were very excited to have me, as I could tell from the emails leading up to yesterday's presentation, which, why I'm doing this here, I'm going to do the presentation for you without the PowerPoint. So you'll miss a couple of things, but maybe I can find a way to put the slides somehow available for you because, yeah, you will miss a couple of things. It was not recorded like the TED Talk, and I thought about posting the speech. I wrote, because this was formal, as opposed to when Jan and I go out for the Lucas County Suicide Prevention Coalition and we bounce off one another, or when I was out at Otsego a couple of weeks ago speaking about anxiety, or last night with NAMI over at the Toledo Police Academy for CIT officers. That's just off-the-cuff, informal, conversational, extemporaneous, which I can do. This was formal. It was at the Renaissance Hotel. I had the lectern. I had a lectern, but I didn't use it. So it was very official. So I wrote a 4,000-word speech. It's about 30 minutes of me speaking. It would probably take you 20 to 40 minutes to read it. So instead of posting it, and perhaps I still will post the actual speech, I wanted to give you the audio. I wanted to give you the full effect of the presentation while it's still fresh in my mind. I wrote the speech, then began to read through it, and then I guess over the last month or so, I began to rehearsing it. For who? Where? For the dogs, for Diddy and Andre. They've heard this a good 15 to 20 times. Rehearsed it once a day, and for the most part, it's memorized. I'd say it's 65 to 70% memorized. There's no way I can memorize 4,000 words. And if you're wondering, Eric, these are your experiences. Why do you need to write them out? Because I wanted to marry the topic to where my strong point is, and that is talking about my mental health experiences. And the hook of this, because this is a young professionals leadership conference, I wanted to talk about something that I've noticed. And I don't want you to think that I'm being old man get off my lawn thing, because as you see in the speech, I think this advice is applicable to anybody of any age, not just the often derided millennials or 18 to 34 year olds. But I have noticed, and I was like this. We feel very entitled when we're in our 20s, like post-college, before we really, really dive into the big steps of our career. And we really get deeply into a company or even that second job. We feel entitled. It's just part of maturing and growing up. But I have noticed, in addition to that 20-something entitlement, I've noticed a lot of people who are struggling to manage failure. Like, and when you have an entitlement, which we all do at that age, most of us do, and then when you're turned down or hit adversity or challenges, and you don't manage it well, you're going to have a world of trouble. So I wanted to explain some of the coping techniques that I use so that you could better manage failure, so that I could tell you to go out and fail. The idea of in culture, for all of life, it's about winning and success and all that stuff like that. And I'll give you this in the speech here momentarily, but I don't want you to think that I'm just yelling at millennials. But to a point, just the other night, on Instagram, there's a beautiful young girl that I follow, and she lamented in an Instagram story that she was sending out lots of resumes for jobs that she was, even in some cases, overly qualified for, and she couldn't understand why people who these jobs knew were getting hired and not her, who likely had a better skill set. And that really hits to the core of this talk, because you're not taught that. As we begin now, and again, I'm sorry I don't have the PowerPoint. I'll do my best while I present this presentation to describe what was up in the PowerPoints. And as I was lucky enough to learn, I'm not a PowerPoint person. This PowerPoint was the very first PowerPoint I created on my own. So there were not transitioning slides and all kinds of brilliant images. It was pretty remedial, but that's good, because I've heard that the PowerPoint presentation is for the presenter, not for the audience. And there's actually very little data in this. There's a picture of my dad and my dogs. Are you ready? I need 30 minutes of your time. Failure. It's an integral component, often the most vital one in what we ultimately hope to achieve. And that's success. We know what that is. A's and 4.0s in classes. Nowadays, the most likes, retweets, and followers, promotions, and the raises that come with them. Or what's most resonated with me as I followed sports most of my life, winning titles and championships and all-star appearances. Is it me? Or when it comes to failure and in the adversity that comes with it, we're only taught how to manage that stuff in the margins of actual learning. This is a slide now of Michael Jordan and his six championships. That is not me. In fact, the only thing Jordan and I have in common is, well, we're both bald. We're both human. He is superhuman, and a lot of our shoes say Nike and Jordan and Air on the back of them. The greatest athlete in any sport in my life didn't get to his godly plateau on his unearthly talent alone. He was relentlessly driven, often to the point of being a menacing scourge to his teammates, his coaches, and certainly opposing players. I just read a quote from a younger peer of his, Allen Iverson, who I grew up enjoying. And Iverson said the first thing Jordan ever said to him was, "What up, you little bitch?" Jordan's competitiveness is historically unrivaled, except for maybe Kobe Bryant, Larry Bird, Tom Brady, and a couple other sports luminaries and legends. Talent and relentless competitiveness. It's often the perfect recipe for any level of success that you want to achieve. But as I said, Jordan didn't just fall into those six championships and an unrelinquishable throne, or nearly. We'll have the LeBron talk in a couple of years. That throne is the greatest basketball player to ever live. He got embarrassed and beaten on his road to the top of sports and culture's Everest of Everest. This is now a slide of Jordan's first few playoff tournaments. Jordan won a single game in his first three playoff appearances. One game in his first three playoff appearances. Then he ran into the fists, sometimes literally, of the Detroit Pistons before finally in June of 1991, Jordan and his Bulls teammates broke through the first of six NBA titles. Could have been a couple of more, but you know he retired to go play minor league baseball for a couple of seasons. If you're a Bulls, Pistons, or sports fan, you may know of Jordan's challenging journey to champion. But for the most part, the failure of legends are typically just footnotes buried in the hallows of their success. When I was a kid, a teenager, a young adult, I was never educated about the vital importance of failure. Like you, I was likely consoled with the trite platitudes like, you'll get them next time. It's not the end of the world. Maybe the most effective one. It'll be okay. Maybe that's all an adolescent brain can handle at that time anyway. I'm not a rags-to-riches story. I can't speak to you about overcoming some horrific physical handicap. I honestly can't tell you the three times in my professional career that I've been fired. It's because I failed or didn't get the job done. They were just simply financial decisions. The truth is, in fact, there are times in my life I've thought, I wish I would have had things a little bit more challenging. I wish I would have faced more adversity and failure so I could manage situation X or situation Y a bit more deftly. Counter to that is, I think I've done a good job, an admirable job of putting myself in a position to succeed personally and professionally. This is a slide of my dad, Barry. He is my very best friend. For the first time, to touch on the true spirit and the ethos of this talk, good mental health and how I got here, my dad is the immovable bedrock in my life that has sincerely kept me alive. However, there's times I look back and wonder if my dad during baseball practice should have hit those ground balls and line drives at me with a little more screaming velocity, or if when I got 1,100 on my SATs, he would have said, Eric, 1,100 is good. Go get 1,200. I think that's the first time I've ever actually spoken critically of my dad. Besides my dogs, he is probably the only genuine love in my life. And if I were to ever get him a corny number one dad t-shirt, it would be far more accurate than you getting your dad a number one dad t-shirt. Between being offered the chance to speak here today and creating this presentation, I saw that iHeartMedia's country version of Ryan Seacrest, Bobby Bones, released a book about failure. When I posted about doing this talk for Epic Toledo on Facebook, I got some suggested links about failure. I'm under no illusions that I'm some kind of pioneer, nor am I at the vanguard of telling you not to shun failure. Fail. Seek out losses. Try things you don't like, and I'm not just talking about food. Try things that are really, really difficult. Put yourself in uncomfortable situations. To a healthy degree, let your ego, and your pride get beaten up. I'm a colossal believer that nothing of any value was learned inside your comfort zone. This is a couple of quotes slides. One from my dad, who often told me, keep doing what you're doing, keep getting what you're getting. The other one is a quote from Einstein and the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Long before those two great wise men, not that much longer, a couple of decades, was Thomas Edison, and about light bulbs. I haven't failed. I found 10,000 ways that won't work. That is called resilience. And I didn't desire to speak here today so that I could finger wag at millennials or 18 to 34-year-olds, because to be quite honest, all of us of any age, gender, race, ethnicity could use a sharpening of our coping skills and resiliency, even though we have more than we give ourselves credit for. This next slide is a couple of excerpts from an article I go back to several times per year. I'll describe it for you now, and reach out to me if you'd like me to share it. This is an article from right before the election in 2012, the presidential election at the time, and it goes back 8 years to the election prior to that. I think that was Bush v. Kerry. It talks about how when we get in these elections, presidential election cycles, and we're concerned about the opponent winning, we all talk about moving to Canada if that person wins. They do the research and the studies months after the election. They find out not really anybody winds up moving to Canada. So why this melodrama? Why this exaggerated hyperbole? For two reasons. One, we get caught up, especially now. And I'll admit, the last several years have been more unconventional and wilder than any other political climate most of us have lived in. We forget that life isn't necessarily about things the president is tweeting about. And I'm not belittling any small issues that you might endure, like racism or misogyny or anything like that. But the world is not having Twitter debates and angrily getting into those things. Our lives are really more mundane. It's oh shit, I was driving down Monroe Street and I should have gone to PetSmart to get food for the dogs because I'm almost out. It was this morning. Oh shit, I broke my fingernail clipper. I have to get one before I... Our life... Did we floss? When is our... Our life is about those mundane things. Secondly, in the same way that our bodies can physically heal itself, themselves, when we sprain an ankle or we get a bruise, our minds are able to do the same. When we face a level of emotional or psychological damage, our minds can heal themselves as well. In short, we have far more resiliency mentally, emotionally, psychologically than we give ourselves credit for. Resiliency. Jordan got it from getting his ball and his butt handed to him by his nemesis, the Pistons and Celtics. Edison got it from having about 9,000 pieces of junk before he landed on the light bulb. I think I began to get mine around the turn of the century, and that seems like such an old person thing to say. Or did I, back then in 2000? This was also the time of the beginning of my personal mental health odyssey, which I hope can empower you to take care of your own mind and your psychological well-being. After starting in radio in 1998, I'd seamlessly moved to Detroit in June of 99 to continue work with my mentor. And I don't know if it worked out because it was just brazen teenage courage or my parents parented an independent and responsible kid. First lesson of the day, I suppose, is, as with most things, it's usually a combination of both things. Sometime into my time in Detroit, I was ready for three words: full-time employment. I began sending out resumes and air checks of my work, editing my previous night's work every day, going to the post office because some places wouldn't accept emails at this point. I spent a lot of my own money going to the post office every day, mailing these things out, and I sent these resumes and pieces of my work to dozens of places all over the country, places I thought I might like to work, people I might like to work for. And of all these things I sent out, I got a couple of thanks, but no thanks. My mentor, Jay, and his boss, Alex, both friends of mine to this day who I can always call upon, they were satisfied. They knew that I was a little stubborn and bullheaded, as we all are at that age, but they were satisfied with my growth. And the coaching that I was taking to. So I couldn't process why my talent wasn't worthy of getting a job at some of these places. It was this time where I began to learn about the politics involved in attaining desirable employment. The most punishing lesson. Again, nothing like this is ever taught to us. Much of the time, it's not about the talent and the skills. Yeah, you got to have a modicum of that stuff, but it's really who you know. In fact, there's a line from a local entrepreneur, Q, who I met in the springtime, and I like this a lot. It's not who you know, it's who knows you, which is exactly how I landed that coveted first full-time job. A morning host role in Orlando, Florida. A guy that I briefly worked with, Steve Bartel, briefly worked with him back home in Philadelphia, had an opening in Orlando at his station where he was program director. He kept in contact with my mentor, Jay, and he was like, in short here, is Eric ready to take this job? Jay said, yeah, he's the guy. So I got this job in Orlando, Florida. Are you familiar with the saying, live by the sword, die by the sword? Get hired by who you know, don't get hired by who you don't know. So around this time in late 02, early 03, I started experiencing thoughts and feelings I'd been unfamiliar with. A slide. It was depression and anxiety. But I was 23, and I had no idea what that stuff was. It wasn't part of my vocabulary. And even if it was, I didn't think that it could possibly affect me. You know, the invincible 20-something. All I did know is that my life is one many people would have traded for. I did my morning show, worked about 5 or 6 hours, and by 11 o'clock in the morning, I was out by one of the 5 palatial pools at this beautiful resort-like apartment complex I lived at. I'd go to I think it was a Gold's Gym at the time, where it was Orlando, Florida. So there were a lot of like athletes and celebrities and faces to know and see at this gym, which was very cool for me when I was 20 years old. I was teaching myself how to cook the George Foreman grill. I'd have some dates. I'd do dates and dinner, watch some TV, do it all over again on the weekends. Perhaps you've heard me talk before about my friend DJ Jake, who was like the social mayor of Orlando. I would DJ in these clubs with Jake. They were packed. I'd get paid hundreds of dollars under the table, not pay for a cent of alcohol, and oftentimes not be home and in bed before 6 a.m. It was Orlando. There was enough eye candy to give you ocular cavities. Those DJ gigs, I bailed on them. And DJ Jake, there was an invisible but tangible force telling me not to go to work that night. And I couldn't figure out why. Maybe I'd eat some pizza, order some Chinese, drink some beers, and this just didn't make sense to me. The social calculus wasn't adding up. Get paid several hundred dollars, do DJ-type things, which included things with really attractive people, for a giant crowder, sit at home. What 20-something is going to go with pepperoni pizza over pretty people? Something was off. Work got a little stressful, too. I was butting heads with Bartel and my co-host, Gloria. But it wasn't anything catastrophic. Again, an easy day. Why was coping with this stuff so difficult? Another slide. With no regard for what we now recognize as stigma, I look for a counselor. It was such a helpful experience, my first giant step on my mental health journey. I still remember her name. I think I remember the name of the first person I slept with. Basically, this woman was an impactful woman in my life. Her name was Dr. Mary Lidke. If you ask me right now to sit down with a sketch artist, I could describe every feature on her face. If she's still alive, they could find her, and I could describe every little detail of her office. That's how impactful it was for me. After Orlando, I kind of moved to my adopted home of Michigan, Saginaw, Michigan, to be exact. It was a drastic meteorological change. But to this day, it was probably the best group of people that I've ever worked with. Brent and Rachel and Nick and PJ. Again, though, more peculiar feelings and behavior, but this time more magnified, more troubling, more worrisome. I called them funks or rallies because, you see, depression and anxiety were not part of my vocabulary yet. It was a malaise of days that I often slugged through or tried to get through, sludge through. A lot of times I didn't get out of bed. And when I did get out of bed, I would count the days, I would count the minutes and hours and seconds till I could get back into bed. Not because bed was comforting, but because for 6 or 7 or 8 hours of sleep, I'd rather deal with dreams or nightmares rather than the thoughts that I was dealing with. I also had like an onslaught of medical problems, air quotes, or so I thought. It all culminated in 2 weeks of nagging chest discomfort. Called my dad and I was panicked. And I alluded to heart attack. And he said, how long has this pain been going on? I said, like at least like 2 weeks. He said, well, congratulations. If it's a heart attack, it's the longest one in human history. And especially for a healthy 25-year-old. It was some combination of acid reflux and anxiety. And to this day, I don't know which one was causing which. Leading up to this was all kinds of pregnancy, STD, cancer, work-related scares. You know, when you get that email, we need to talk. I would be paralyzed with anxiety. All this was conjured up by my own imagination. You know, we're taught as kids, imagination is a wonderful thing, unless it's working against you. My mind was not healthy. Again, eschewing any kind of stigma, I went to another therapist. I had a good life. Friends, family members, money, work. I just wanted to enjoy the good that I had created for myself, and I couldn't. I was living a joyless, apathetic life. I explained just about all of this stuff in my head to the best of my ability to this therapist, and that's often a challenge when you sit down for the first time with a mental health professional to get your thoughts and behaviors and feelings into the correct words so you can get a good diagnosis. To this day, this is one of the greatest days of my life. She gave me a diagnosis of bipolar type 2, a lesser form of the disorder. I know I high-fived her. I think I might even hugged her, which I know surprises a lot of you. She's like, this is not the response I usually get when I give someone a mental health diagnosis. I was like, you don't know. You've just given me. She gave me a Waze or a Google Maps app of the problem I was encountering. She gave me hope. Unstoppable Force, Minutes, Immovable Object, Optimus Prime, found his Megatron, Batman had his Joker, I had a mental health disorder. I kept up with therapy, but I also decided to get some books, and now this is a slide of a couple of books, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Dummies and the Feeling Good Handbook, and the content in them was very easy to read, easy to digest, and easy to apply in small ways in everyday life, but the techniques, they were helpful coping skills, but they weren't enough. I hit a professional peak in 2009. Kind of sad, isn't it? I got the autonomy to program a top 40 station I'd been working at for a few years now, close to home, in Philadelphia, in Allentown, PA. I also got to do a sports talk radio show every single day. With more responsibilities meant more stress, and with the company in tumultuous and dire financial times, there was a lot of unexpected corporate pressures and pushdowns that I was unfamiliar with, and mentally, I didn't manage them very well at all. A regular depression sunk in, and it cycled into my life more regularly. This is now a slide about a lot of suicide stats and a person with a gun to their head. I never attempted suicide, but to this day, I have ideations. There was a time I was on the phone with my dad while I was living in Allentown, driving on a highway. And I was angry and exasperated that I would wake up each day without any joy, without enjoying things that I knew I liked. And I said to my dad as I was driving on the phone, "Dad, I don't care right now. I've jerked this wheel to the side and I crashed and died. I just wouldn't care." There was a silence and a chill on the other end of the phone. That was one of the times I vowed that I could never do that to my dad. I was fortunate enough to learn in the early readings, and I was in voracious reader and avid self-learner even to this day. So I was reading up on this bipolar stuff, and I was fortunate enough to learn or to read a line that suicide can be selfish. Not the intent, but the act, because of the immense emotional shrapnel and collateral damage that flies when you kill yourself. So whenever I do have those thoughts, I think about my dad and how I can't leave him. My dogs as well. There are too many people, starting with my dad and my dogs and my coworkers and even you and people that I go talk to with the Lucas County Suicide Prevention Coalition and other mental health talks. In a slightly joking way, I would be a hypocrite. I would lose my credibility if I go out and talk about how I get myself into good places and then I kill myself. I may be the 1 in 4 American adults who has a mental health issue, but I do my best to make sure that I don't slip into the 1 in 25 American adults who has a severe issue like PTSD or schizophrenia or a variety of psychoses. 90% of suicides are connected to mental health. A healthy mind does not wake up and say, "I want to die today." For 250,000 years, human beings have been on this planet trying to achieve one thing: survival, stay alive. If your brain says you need to die, something is wrong. I thought my coping skills were decent, but I knew the bipolar was in play. So I decided trying medication would be worth a shot so that I could find the mental clarity, so that I could use the techniques that I was learning to help manage my mind. The depression created a barrier, and I just hoped the medication would erode it. Those medications were Lamictal and Abilify, and they did help. They did lift my mood. But there was also some unfriendly side effects. The biggest one, I felt tired, sedated practically. Every day at 3 o'clock, I needed a gigantic Dunkin' Donuts coffee to keep from falling asleep. And sometimes I did. And again, my mood was lifted. But every night at 8 o'clock, I needed to go to bed. I couldn't stay up any longer. So while my mood was lifted, I felt depressed because I couldn't take advantage of the better mood because I needed to go to bed at 8 o'clock. Unwisely, nearly deadly, I gave up the medications cold turkey. Don't do that. But I did remain committed to therapy and continuing to read on what was going on with me. And I immersed myself deeper into my work and even looked for a new challenge, which I got in 2012. Back in Detroit at a sports talk station that needed almost a complete rebuilding. Little did I know it was going to be the most distressing professional year of my career and leave my personal life in utter desolation. Asked to bring that station back to its halcyon days of high ratings, high revenue, I was asked to submit a progressive, digital, forward-thinking strategy for the future and a vision for the station. And I did. And a couple of days later, they cut 1/4 of the staff. A couple of months later, they fired the operations manager, who I worked really well with, who had initially hired me, and replaced him with the guy that fired me from iHeartMedia and Kiss FM a year and a half ago, who we'd always text personal things to about baseball and stuff like that. We didn't get along well professionally. I'm not going to give him a third opportunity to go for the hat trick. Another lesson. Sometimes people just don't work well professionally together, no matter how well they are off professionally. He and I were like, if you gave my dad unlimited Fortnite play, this is just not going to work out. Every neuron that my depression and anxiety could ignite during that 2012 brought me to the nadir, to the through to the nadir of my existence. Hi. With that came an immense amount of learning, though, and I needed to follow my own advice. I failed emotionally and psychologically. I couldn't cope, and I had to act. First, I needed to have a dog in my life. I had left Jasmine, my dog, back home with family in Philadelphia for family reasons. My dad said, maybe you miss Jasmine. And as most of us do, I scoffed at my dad's advice. 10 days later, I was like, you know what? I need a dog in my life. So I go and adopt Diddy. A couple of years later, I got Andre. Dogs are animals, especially animal lovers. They make us feel great. There's never been a time in my life where I've come home and the dogs are not happy to see me. Diddy's on the couch playing video games. Andre's sitting on the iPad, smoking a cigarette, watching some porn. They run to the door and they are so excited to see me. I work with a program called HARP here in Toledo, Hope and Recovery Pets Program, co-founded by Dr. Janet Hoy-Gerlach from UT. One of the other partners is ProMedica, also the Toledo Humane Society, who provides free animal adoptions. And when I mean free, I mean the whole kit and caboodle. Vet visits, food, all of it, to chronically ill mental health patients. And all you got to do is let Dr. Janet swab you for some oxytocin, a bonding chemical in us humans, more so I believe in women, so that Janet can come back every couple of months after you've adopted that pet that you've fallen in love with, and she can go, oh, the oxytocin's going up. You know what it's like when you're in research to get further funding and grants. You got to show that data, and Janet's providing that. So I got my dogs. Secondly, I learned about an EAP, the Employee Assistance Program, and why you need to use it. Often, it's just something baked in to your insurance PDF. It offers anonymous phone calls and help for relationships, financial help. I use mine to find a therapist. And I often equate finding the right therapist to dating in marriage. You swipe right, you swipe left, you use some dating apps, you meet some people for some coffee, you get in relationships, and then hopefully, fortunately, you find your soulmate, that person who can finish your thoughts, who can tell you that you want Chick-fil-A even before you're hungry, that person. You can have the same, well, a similar symbiotic relationship with a therapist who can put those thoughts and feelings of yours into words and help you find mental clarity. But it might not be the first or second therapist. It might be the third visit with the third counselor who you find that relationship with. And you can use those EAP visits because they're often free, 3, 5, 7, 9 of them to find that person. Third, with depression causing me a great deal of existential questions like, should I still be doing radio? Should I just move home to Philadelphia and try to enjoy family a little bit more? I went out and visited with a career counselor. And after some very expensive career testing, found that I'm an ENTP, or was, and that I belong in media. No shit. But from her, I took the 50-50 principle of work. You need to tolerate 50% of what you do for the 50% that you love, the 50% that you get out of bed for every day. Aha! I was fortunate enough for the majority of my career to have that number like 80-20 love to tolerate. And to be quite honest, whatever my next 50-hour-a-week venture is, I don't know if I could do 65-35 because I've been so fortunate to have it those numbers 80-20 or around that. Happiness is a currency. It doesn't pay bills. I can't write happy to Buckeye or for my Columbia or Edison bills and have them keep my utilities on. But happiness can help you power through a less than desirable paycheck because you enjoy what you do, who you do it for, and who you do it with. I hope you all make all the money you deserve and want, but I'd much rather have you happy than wiping your nose and butt with $20 bills for tissues and toilet paper. There's a Dan Pink TED Talk that I go back to regularly, and he talks about how important the intrinsic motivators are versus the extrinsic. Conversely, don't make your calling your curse, because your employer throws money at you and promotions and raises and all that stuff. Don't let them make your personal time their professional time. It will burn you out. Lastly, 2012 was so fraught, I got back on medication, Wellbutrin, and I swore to myself I had to stay on it regardless of the side effects because I couldn't live a life. I couldn't exist waking up every day depressed, in despair, dreading things, riddled with anxiety and worse than anything, wanting to die, or at least not live. Where are we now? The suicidal ideations are rare, and they're often more a fantasy than anything, and I've got a mental health crew of Avengers surrounding me, like Dr. Andrea, my friend Bill Berry from NAMI, and many, many more, my therapist who is my friend. They've helped me excise the toxicity, people, places, things in my life, and I know I can tap into them when I need to. Much of this is thanks to the medication I'm currently on, Cymbalta, which a doctor friend, an orthopedist friend, suggested to me because they often prescribe it for rheumatoid arthritis patients. Apparently, it's a mental health medication. I believe it's an antidepressant, but there's a positive side effect that helps RA people with their flare-ups. From 2007 on, I was dealing with a lot of tendonitis, strains, pains, joint issues that would mimic arthritis, tendonitis. I'd go from doctor to doctor, scan to scan, specialist to specialist, and they would say, "You have inflammation." Well, no shit. There was no direct trauma that caused it, physically speaking. I was immolating my body from the inside. I was burning myself to pieces because of stress, depression, and anxiety. Obviously, one of the great elixirs for those things are being physical. And you know, I enjoy going to the gym, but I couldn't work out the way I wanted to. And you know what that did? Caused me even more depression and other things. The Cymbalta didn't really do what I had hoped it would and eliminate the strains, but it did conquer my anxiety, which nobody had ever diagnosed before. My imagination no longer got the better of me when I got a "we need to talk" text or email, or when Andre stuck his paw into something outside near a Christmas lighting and he electrocuted himself. I was able to keep myself sane and rational instead of being as panicked as he was. Less stress, being better able to manage it, gave me some of my life back. Best of all, I can put some of my top coping skills in action personally and professionally. But finding that proper medication, it's like finding that therapist. It might not be the first or second medication, and it can be frustrating, financially taxing as well. Maybe it's a combination of the first and fourth medication. And if you choose to go the route of medication, if it's best for you, once you find what works for you, you will unlock a you that has long been dormant and covered up and masked and shrouded by these mental health symptoms that I've always dealt with. Another thing, I know my triggers. And when you're dealing with a mental health issue, you need to be acutely aware of them. Stress, too much alcohol for me, weather changes, daily routine alterations, certain types of people, just things that happen in life. And when they get the better of me, a cloud of havoc and depression begins to form above my head. It says, "You need to have like 8 drinks tonight. You know what? Just stay in bed today. You know what? You don't want to go hang out with friends." I knew to get away from that cloud, to shrink, and I need to do the opposite of what it says. I need to, "Okay, you want to have a drink? Don't have 8. Have 2 and then call it a night. You need to get out of bed. Even if it's just getting to the couch and watching Netflix, you need to accept that invite to go hang out with friends. Even if it's just for 10 minutes, maybe you'll see somebody you haven't caught up with in a while. If that cloud becomes too formidable, maybe it's time for a visit with my therapist, who is my friend and we often have coffee, but I mean an official visit. Maybe it's time to go visit my doctor, Dr. Sean, who manages my medications. Let's go back to the David Burns book, The Feeling Good Handbook. It is my cognitive behavioral Bible. A couple of the techniques I use most often from it are, what's the worst that can happen? We all have anxiety when we see someone that we're attracted to and we'd like to talk to. Oftentimes this happens to me at the gym. What's the worst that could happen if I go over and talk to that woman I find attractive? She runs up to the manager saying, "This guy accosted me," or "He tried to assault me." Well, I would never, I'm awkward, but I would never do those such things. "Hey, what's your name?" Is not either. Well, what if that's her boyfriend over there and he's very jealous? He throws a dumbbell at my head. Well, that is a lawsuit I'm going to win. What's the worst that could happen? Fortune telling. If we were all fortune tellers accurately, we would have won Powerball or Mega Millions. Our fortune telling, don't be one. You're not one. And anxiety is the fortunes we try to expose. Our anxiety is lying to us 90% of the time. Don't believe it. Believe the 2% of the time. Like the, "Hey, we need to talk." Oh, shit. She's pregnant. Oh, shit. I'm getting fired. Oh, shit. He just wanted to know what kind of beer I wanted or what I wanted on pizza. Don't be a fortune teller. Lastly, flooding or immersion myth that Dr. Andrea talk about and I talk about all the time. And I use the example of the movie Batman Begins when Bruce Wayne descends down into the proto-Bat cave. He's not Batman yet, but the place below Wayne Manor. It's dark, it's damp, it's scary. He hears the bats and he crouches down. And then the thousands of bats begin to swirl all around him. And then as the Hans Zimmer music kicks in, he rises up, kind of closes his eye, and you can see him immersing himself in it. And he's taking it all in, but at the same time shedding his fear. If you approach your irrational fear, there's a good chance if you can just sit through it and sweat it out, you'll overcome that fear or that anxiety. And by the way, I said irrational. Don't throw yourself into a pit of venomous snakes and don't go swim with sharks without a cage. Eric, you should do this for your Band-Aid thing. No fucking chance. A couple of other things. Apparently, this hit hard really last night to one of the sergeants at the Toledo Police Academy. We'll get to that in a second. Do what works for you. You know I can't meditate. You know I like to sit in the shower because I like it. I can't meditate in traditional ways, sometimes I'll do what's called a body scan. Or I wash my dishes by hand because one place I live didn't have a dishwasher. And sometimes I just immerse myself in that. I feel every droplet of water hitting my hand. I feel the texture of the sponge. I feel the water changing temperatures. And it's a good way for me to be mindful. This is the thing the sergeant mentioned last night she'd never heard. A friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, good friend of mine, said his nephew was talking about a lot of things that I've talked about that he and I have discussed before. And he said, I just can't get through to him. He ignores my phone calls when we hang out. He won't let me bring it up. I said, ask him this. Do you want to feel better? No matter how suicidal, depressed, or how dark the darkness was looming over me, if somebody would have just said to me, do you want to feel better? My answer would have been, fuck yeah. I just didn't know that I could. I thought I was locked in this prison of depression. But there was hope and help available, and hopefully I've offered you some of that here today. So these coping skills help with my bipolar. They corral it and the wicked depression and anxiety that come along with it. And they allow me to implement a couple of personal and professional tenets of mine. They're up on the slide that you can't see. If you're an employer, aim to get people to work with you, not for you. How do you do that? Be compassionate, be authentic, be genuine. This will create the loyalty you're looking for. Strive not to make your lofty expectations theirs. Look, you got the responsibilities that you did because you've got those high expectations. But if you put those on other people, you will sow discord. Lastly, attempt to be a leader, not a manager. A leader inspires people. A manager just pecks out emails behind their desk and fires those off. In fact, I'm stealing this line directly from last week's episode of Chicago Fire, a show I now love. A leader turns good people into great people. A manager doesn't do that. Don't let things happen to you. Go and happen to things. Thank you, Leonardo da Vinci. For instance, go find the uncomfortable and the challenging. They are great elixirs for growth and especially depression. Work on your obituary and your resume will take care of itself. Too often, many of us lose sight of that. Because I have my mind right, or at least more of an ally and less of a foe, I'm able to do what I'm suggesting you do. Go out and fail. Take losses. Fall down. Seek it out. Go to bed each night a little bit better of a person than when you woke up. Be the best for the world, not the best in the world.
This has been a Cumulus Media and Q105 collaboration. Three unicorns were harmed and lost their rainbows and horns in the production process. We use cookies for various purposes, like eating and flavor for protein shakes. And you have agreed to this and all other secret policies by enjoying the preceding audio content, which we highly encourage you to hashtag subscribe and share. You can click here for all other legal crap. And now hit skip intro to go to the next podcast. Just kidding. It's the See More Episodes option in your app. Q105.